Okay, it is August 17th, 2003, and I'm Andrea Meisterwan with Carolyn Bertozzi in her office at the Chemistry Department at UC Berkeley for her oral history interview for the Pew Scholars Program in the Biomedical Sciences. And we'll start up at the very beginning, and I'll ask you where and when you were born.
Boston, Massachusetts, 1966.
Okay. And I know from your website that you basically science is a family business.
Yeah, that's
right. So to speak. So why don't you tell me a little bit about your parents' background?
Okay.
Your family background.
Well, my dad is the fifth child of immigrants from Italy who came over in the early 19-teens, I guess, and landed in outside of Boston. And now he's a physics professor at MIT, and he was at MIT his entire life, pretty much. You know, he was an undergraduate, graduate student, assistant professor, all the way through, all at MIT. And his older siblings, some of whom are still alive, he's in his early 70s, and the oldest child of that family is still alive, and he's maybe 90 or so now. Many of those children were scientists. I guess the oldest, my uncle, you know, the oldest was a chemist who worked for Morton Thiokol. And one of the intermediate sisters was a science, like a junior high school science teacher outside of Boston, and she passed away a few years ago. There's another sister that's still alive. She was a nurse. And there was another brother who died when I was very young, who I didn't really know. And, you know, they grew up very poor, on welfare. You know, this is, they were basically, his my dad's mother, my grandmother, was very active in the Socialist Party in Italy, and that's why they fled, actually.
Okay.
It was because her life was at risk. So when Mussolini came to power, you know, but she was apparently a very progressive, very active, and very literate person, and she founded one of the very first child care centers in Italy for working moms, to help moms become working moms. And again, this is back in the 19-teens, this is very early on. And her husband, which was my grandfather, was not literate. He was a farmer. And so when they fled the country, she had to pose as his peasant wife and hide the fact that she, you know, was a reader and a writer, because that would have made her suspect. So when they came to the United States, they had nothing. You know, they basically built a farm and sort of lived on food stamps. And then came the Depression, you know. And so, you know, they grew up poor. So all of those kids in that family were, they grew up in an environment where their mom enforced education. So she encouraged them to study hard, work hard, and, you know, they're very much believers in the American dream, that if you came to America and you worked really hard, you can make something of yourself, even though you start with nothing. So all of them ended up going to basically on full scholarships to college. Every single one of those kids went to college, even the women. And so anyways, as I was saying about my parents, my father's side of the family, so they all went to college, and most of them got higher degrees. And so for the women, those were degrees in like nursing and education. For the men, including my dad, it was like a PhD or a master's degree. And so then my dad was a graduate student at MIT when he met my mother, and she was a secretary at MIT. So then my mom comes from a family that came to the United States from Canada. They're from Nova Scotia, and they landed in the Boston area too. And so this was kind of a different family, because they didn't have this sort of rich tradition of education. My mom has one brother who's about 17 years older than her. And so she basically grew up as an only child, because he was pretty much out of the house by the time she was aware of things. And her father owned a store, a little corner store, like a mom-and-pop store. And I don't remember him very well. He died when I was... all my grandparents died when I was kind of in elementary school, with the exception of my mother's mother, who passed away when I was a postdoc. And she lived to be 100. So, but the other grandparents I didn't know very well. I only know their stories, you know. So, but I remembered my mother's father as being kind of a mean old guy, and he had a stroke when I was pretty young, which left him sort of immobilized and kind of making a lot of noises I couldn't understand. So when you're a kid, you know, you're afraid of stuff like that, and so that's kind of how I remember him. And then thankfully he died, because he was a tremendous burden on my grandmother, who was just basically waiting on him. They lived in some sort of cheap, low-income housing for the elderly in Watertown, Mass. But that grandmother was the grandparent I knew the best because she lived, you know, through my early adulthood, or mid-adulthood, really. And so when I was a kid, she would come over and babysit a lot, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So my mom, her story is that, again, she's a child of the Depression, you know, so she and my dad both grew up in times when you scrimped and saved every little penny, and when you education was the most important thing, mm-hmm. and the most coveted of all jobs was to be a tenured professor somewhere because your job was secure.
Okay.
You know, any other job was not secure back then. Mm-hmm. And so that was part of their, I think, the driving force, you know, to have this high esteem for academia. But also in the Boston area, that's, you know, you're just surrounded by universities and professors and this very academic environment. And anecdotally, when I came out to California, that was another sort of surprise to me because I had grown up in Boston, went to college in Boston, and I came out here and it's very different. You know, the whole environment wasn't like dominated by universities. And in fact, a lot of the students, college students that I TA'd, you know, and then later as a professor taught, have no interest in higher education beyond college. You know, they went to college because they're supposed to, but after that they just want to get a job. And the jobs in their community that were held in high esteem might have been the local optometrist, mm-hmm. right, you know. And they thought of being a professor at a university as a less appealing job because the salary wasn't as high, and so therefore it didn't hold as much esteem in their family. Whereas in my family, salary was irrelevant. The fact that it was a secure job is what made it so important. Mm-hmm. But again, I think that comes from the Depression, you know. Mm-hmm.
Was your dad born in Italy then?
Dad was not. No, his siblings were, and he was not.
He was born.
He was born shortly after they got here.
Okay. Yeah. And he was the youngest then.
He might have been conceived in Italy. You know, I don't know. He was the youngest of five.
Yeah. And did your paternal did his mother go to the university in Italy?
I don't know her educational background.
Yeah. Okay.
I only know that she, you know, had authored a lot of documents, and, you know, she had written a lot. She was considered an activist of her time, you know, for women's rights.
Yeah, and did she stay activist when she moved to the United States?
No, not that I remember. I think she was just trying to survive and feed her family, you know, and again, they had a farm out in Framingham, Massachusetts, which at that time was all farmland. Now it's strip malls, you know, and, you know, they were on food stamps, they were on welfare. You know, I think at that time you immigrated here, neither of them spoke any English. They never really spoke English even after, like, I never heard either of them speak any English.
Yeah.
And they both died when I was around 8. And so I don't know if they ever really learned English. So, you know, I don't know that it would have been easy for them to work in this country. And also, you know, poor immigrants were just treated like dirt, you know, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And they weren't religious at all, so they shunned religion. They thought of religion as opiate of the masses and so on,
right.
You know.
Okay.
And so, and at that time, again, in Massachusetts, you know, if you didn't have a religion that you subscribed to, you were ostracized by the community. And so, you know, they settled outside of Boston, and they would have the local ministers and priests coming to their house, like, you've got to bring your children to church. If you don't bring those children to church, they're going to grow up and go to hell, and so on. And my dad's grandparents didn't want anything to do with it, you know, so they didn't want their kids in religion, they didn't want religion in their house, and so on. And that also further, I think, alienated them, not just from the local non-immigrant culture, but from their own Italian immigrant.
Just,
you know, their community was a very Catholic community, and they didn't want anything to do with the Catholic Church.
Mm-hmm.
So my dad grew up as an atheist, and even when I was a kid, he didn't want us to really have much to do with going to church.
Mm-hmm.
But my mother came from a family that had a little more tradition, so they were Protestants, you know, and so she brought us to church when we were kids, and I got confirmed in the Protestant church and so on. But my dad didn't want anything to do with it.
Yeah. Well, was your mother born in Canada or her
She was born in the States.
So her family had come to Canada before
They came from Nova Scotia because just to find work. There were no jobs up there. Lunenburg, Nova Scotia is a little fisherman's town.
Yeah.
And, you know, again, the Depression really hit Canada and the United States, I think.
Yeah.
Well, the world, I guess, but, you know.
Okay.
Anyway, so my mom grew up in a family where I think, you know, her mother was a little bit older,
mm-hmm.
and I think, you know, since this could go on record, I won't say, but, you know, it's not clear that she was a planned pregnancy and so on. And I think she grew up as an only child, basically, and not that close to her parents, kind of out living her own life, sort of. She's very independent. And she was a very good high school student. Mm-hmm. You know, she was always, like, at the top of her class and so on in high school. And she wanted to go to college, but didn't have the means to go. And her parents, I think, had a style with her, which was, you know, they didn't want to give her any money. They thought it was a waste of money to have a girl go to college. Mm. And even, you know, when she graduated from high school, they started to charge her rent to live in her house and so on. You know, she had to get a job and work. And she had stories, like, she, you know, she was pretty good at sports. She wanted to play on the basketball team, but she couldn't because she had to work after school every day to earn the money to stay in her house and buy her clothes and whatever she needed for school. So, you know, I think she might have some bitterness about that now. I don't know. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so her take on education was that, you know, the sort of the message I got from her growing up was that if you don't go to college and get an education, you're going to end up like me, is not much choice in life other than to get married and have kids. Yes. Mm-hmm. And that she felt like was her option in life was to get married and have kids, and there was no real career option for her. So she, you know, being near the top of her class, she was able to, and working on part-time all the time, she was able to put the money together to go to, I guess, I don't know what they would have called it then, but it's sort of secretarial school.
Oh, yeah.
So to learn shorthand and all these things. And then, again, being at the top of her class there, she was able to get one of the best secretarial jobs, which was at MIT. Right? So that, you know, the top women would get, like, the best secretary jobs, the best nursing jobs. And MIT was considered kind of a top choice because those were the most eligible young men that you would meet.
Oh, okay.
And again, this is like late 40s, early 50s. After the war, when physics reigned, right,
yeah.
Because nuclear physics saved the world, right, as a nuclear bomb and so on. And my dad was a nuclear physicist because that was hot. Everyone, just like now everyone wants to solve the human genome or whatever,
right,
and cure cancer. Back then everyone wanted to be a nuclear physicist and build bombs and save the world. And so, you know, I think that was considered, like, the best sort of shopping ground for husbands was in this environment. But my mom also really enjoyed it there because it was stimulating. She got to be around smart people who read books and would talk about them. And also, back in those days, the secretaries were much more integrated into academic life because those were the only women around, right? So when men had academic parties, to have any women there at all, you had to invite your secretaries, pretty much. You know, and so she really knew all the professors and the grad students, and they'd have outings to the beach on the weekends and stuff. They hung out together. And the secretaries were usually these very educated, articulate women who, in my day, would now be a professor like me, you know,
right.
But in that day, that's kind of, you know, where they would go. And so she really, I think, enjoyed working there and having her career as a secretary and getting into the politics. And she's got these old photographs of herself, like, at the beach with Niels Bohr and Robert Oppenheimer.
Oh,
yeah, people like that.
Yeah.
And she was in that circle, you know.
Yeah.
And that's where she met my dad, because he was a grad student there.
Okay. Yeah.
And they got married and so on.
Right. And what do you think inspired your father's side of the family that all his siblings and himself went into the sciences?
Well, they were good at it.
Okay.
I think it, you know, like, people like to do what they're good at, and physics and math came easy to him.
Okay.
So that's why he did it, I think.
Yeah.
He never liked chemistry. He said he took, like, organic chemistry in college, maybe, and just didn't understand it, didn't like it.
Yeah.
But physics was just, you know, nope, he picked it right out.
Yeah. Okay. And so what were the expectations, you mentioned this briefly before, from both your parents in terms of what you and your siblings should do with your lives in terms of educational opportunities, but also career choices?
Well, you know, when we were growing up, I think, there was no question we would go to college, of course.
Okay.
I mean, that was just a foregone conclusion. And, you know, we were like little five-year-olds with MIT t-shirts on and so on, you know. And then, you know, I sort of always got the sense that, you know, it was expected of me to major in something having to do with the sciences, but it would be okay to go outside of the sciences as long as it was something practical where you could get a job.
Okay.
That was the emphasis. And I was kind of into music as a kid, and I, you know, toyed with the idea in my head of being a music major in college, and I'd sometimes casually mention it to my mom, and she'd flip. You know, because you can make a living, you know.
Okay.
And in case there was any doubt of that, there was evidence in my own family, because I have this older cousin who had majored in music at Harvard and, in fact, couldn't make a living afterwards, you know, and was teaching little kiddie violin lessons for a few bucks here and there and ended up having to go back to school and get a computer degree, and now she's some computer manager at a bank or something.
Yeah.
But, you know, so that was always like, oh, you'll never get a job, and, you know, you need to major in something where you can get a job. And so that could, you know, could have been like journalism. That would have been acceptable. And certainly medical school would have been fine, you know, no matter what the major was, as long as I was, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So that's kind of the message that I got, sometimes verbally, sometimes sort of indirectly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
All of us got that message, I think. There were three of us.
Okay.
Yeah.
And let's talk about your siblings, who they are. I know one of them's a math professor, and what they do.
So my older sister, Andrea, is the math professor now at UCLA. Mm-hmm. And I have a younger sister, Diana. So Andrea's 1 year older than I am. Mm-hmm. Diana's 3 years younger than I am. Mm-hmm. And Diana is an occupational therapist, and she works at a hospital in New Jersey.
Okay. Yeah.
That's her story.
We all went to college.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Andrea was 1 year ahead of me, and so she was kind of the genius of the family. And so, you know, the story of my life was always trying to keep up with my older sister, you know. Mm-hmm. And she was, you know, math is one of those things where I don't think you can learn to be really good at math or work hard to be good at math. You're just either good at it or not, you know. And she and when you're really good at it, usually that's clear when you're like 4 years old. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So she was one of those little kids who was doing the Rubik's Cube in 2 seconds, you know, and you know what I mean? And when everyone else is out playing, she was at home doing math puzzles because it was more fun, you know, than going out to play. Mm-hmm. And she was, like, too smart for the math classes in junior high school. They had to ship her off to the high school for math because, you know, stuff like that. Mm-hmm. So although she wasn't, like, a total geek because she had other things. She played the flute very well in the state orchestra and all that kind of stuff. And she worked as a lifeguard in the summer just to be cool, you know, for a period of time. And I was sort of not as smart as she was. Like, at least I didn't have that kind of obvious genius thing going. Mm-hmm. You know, like, the junior high school math was just fine for me, you know, and so on. And so because we were a year apart, I pretty much had the same teacher she had, but a year later. Mm-hmm. And it was always like, oh, it's Andrea's little sister. Well, are you as smart as your older sister is? And I just say no and get it out of the way. But I was pretty smart, you know. I just had a different kind of smart than she had, you know. Yeah. And then my younger sister totally gave up altogether because she had to follow the two brainy older sisters. And so she had the classic younger sibling, screw it, I'm just going to screw up in school and go out and party and have fun. And so she, you know, had rocky spots, like in high school where she was pulling D's and C's. And in high school, that's pretty bad, you know. We really have to do much to get A or B. And then she was, like, hanging out with kind of scuzzy boyfriends and stuff. And then she did go to college. So my older sister went to Princeton and majored in math and then stayed at Princeton, went to grad school, and then went to postdoc at University of Chicago for a few years. And then she was hired with tenure immediately at Duke.
Wow.
And that she was, because she's so smart and so on, right? My younger sister went to Worcester, College of Worcester in Ohio. Mm-hmm. It's a little liberal arts place for 1 year, and she failed out. Mm-hmm. And she was partying all the time and not studying at all. And then, you know, the kind of the, you know, what hit the fan, you know, she had to go back home. My mom was, you know, in my family, you don't even get a B, much less fail out, certainly not in college. I mean, this was like the travesty of the family, you know. So it was the worst thing conceivable for my parents to have to deal with this. And so, you know, she kind of she was living at home and working some sort of crappy jobs at the mall, kind of, you know, behind the counter and so on. And then my mom talked her into taking some colleges at Middlesex Community College, which is a local thing. And in fact, my mom, at this point, also decided she wanted a college degree. So she was in her 60s at the time, and she'd never been to college, you know, not in the conventional sense. Mm-hmm. So my mom, the way my mom puts it, she said that she decided that she would sign up for some classes at Middlesex to kind of encourage Diana to do these classes at Middlesex, and they'd go there together or something. But actually, I think my mom really just wanted to do that herself, with or without Diana, but it was a good excuse for her to do it. Maybe it gave her the extra motivation to do it. So so Diana went and took these classes, and, you know, so she kind of screwed up in college. She was young, 17, 18. Now it's a few years later. She's kind of grown up a bit, you know. And I think she also started to get the sense that, you know, working at the Sharper Image, you know, behind the counter is just not that fulfilling forever, you know. So she did pretty well. She got some good grades at Middlesex in some classes, like, I think, psychology type classes. She was interested in psych. And so then she was able to transfer those credits to Northeastern. She got into Northeastern, which is in Boston, you know. And it turns out, so it's funny, because when she first went to college, my parents' assumption was that, you know, she was less academically motivated and therefore would be better at a small school where they get more attention. But in fact, that was not the case, because for whatever reason, that small school was too claustrophobic for her or something. And Northeastern is just a big city commuter school, and kids live out wherever, and they drive in there. And so it's a much more serious place, actually, because you're not living there getting drunk on the weekends in these frats, and you know what I mean? Like, these kids are mostly working part-time and supporting themselves in school. It's a little older crowd, you know. It's a huge university, you know, but mostly commuter. And she actually, I think she got some confidence. You know, she had some better grades at Middlesex than she'd ever had in high school, or certainly at Worcester, where she failed out, and started to feel like she was maybe good at something, you know. And then she went to, so in Northeastern, she majored in psych, and she had this one professor who kind of took an interest in her, like academically, and encouraged her and said, you know, you're really good at this, and invited her to kind of work, do research with him kind of on the side. So she did this research project. And then he said to her, you know, you should really continue on and get like a master's degree in something because you're really good at this. And it was sort of the first authority figure in academia who said you're really good at something as opposed to you're dumber than your two older sisters.
Yeah.
I think even my parents, unfortunately, sent her the message that she was dumber than her two older sisters.
Oh, great.
You know? Because they would, you know, she'd say, oh, maybe I'll be a doctor when I grow up. And they'd say, well, but I don't know if you're going to be a doctor, but you could probably be a nurse. You know, they'd say things like that, you know. They would never admit it, but now it's on record. But anyway, so... So she went on and got a, she did get, go on, she went to BU, got a master's degree in occupational therapy, decided that was her thing. And so that's what she does now, she's an OT.
Yeah. Okay, well, how much science was around the house, with your dad being a physicist and your mom working in a physics department and socializing with physicists, how much science was brought home because of your...
Well, first of all, but when we were born, my mom stopped working.
Okay.
So she was never working when I was a young kid, although she kind of went back and... A little bit when I was in high school, she had a part-time secretarial job at Harvard, which she hated, and she quit that. So she was really essentially not working.
Okay.
But my dad always had a lot of gadgets around the house, just junk from work that he'd bring home. And so the one that had made an impression on me was when I was a little kid, he had this huge magnet that he brought home, big thing. And it was like this amazing thing where you'd like throw paper clips at it and it would fling them across the room and stuff like that, you know. And we'd stick our dolls to it. And you know, when I was a kid, like, my Christmas present would be, like, an optics kit, you know, where you build your own camera, kind of stuff like that, you know, and we used to go and hang out at his office sometimes, like, he'd sometimes bring us in there, and, you know, it was all mysterious to us, but one thing that he did have was a computer, and when we were kids, he brought home this terminal, so this is back in the day. How old are you?
I'm your age.
Okay, so you know what I'm talking about then, because my students have no idea what I'm talking about.
I know what you're going to say.
These terminals, you'd bring them home and plug your phone into the back, and there was the two things for the telephone, and there's an old-fashioned phone.
Mm-hmm.
So there'd be two holes for the old-fashioned phone, and you'd dial up, you know, like a modem, and the phone would go, wee, and you'd plug it in, and this thing was a terminal. It was like a typewriter. But this was before anybody could play with a computer, you know. There was no person actually had access to computers at this point in time. You know, this is when I was, I mean, this is like in the 70s, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Computer was like this big thing, and only at Digital or Honeywell or something, big mainframes, right? And you could program this thing in BASIC, you know, to like add 2 + 2 and give you 4. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Stuff like that. So that was fun, and we'd play with that. And then at his work, they had computers around because he was an experimental physicist.
Mm-hmm.
He built big instruments. And some of these really early games, like Space Wars and stuff, we were playing back before anybody else had a computer, you know. So that was kind of cool in retrospect.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and my dad was a builder. You know, he was really good at building stuff, and that's, you know, for him, physics was all about building instruments, building big beam lines and stuff. And so he'd have us in the basement. He had 3 daughters. He never got his son. They tried. Diana was their last shot, you know. So he, you know, they were traditional, so they thought the son would be the one that would help dad in the basement building things, and the girls would be whatever. But and so all he had was us. So he had us in the basement helping him build stuff. So we helped build a house. You know, we built a house. We moved to a new house that we built when I was like in 7 or 8. And, you know, I put together one of the stone walls and he showed me how to do the masonry and stuff. You know, I mean, that was kind of...
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's not really science, but it's, you know, it was like non-traditional things, which I think is maybe more the point, you know, for girls.
Tinkering.
Yeah, I think for girls growing up, you know, who ultimately end up in science, whether or not they were in science as kids is less important than that they were able to do sort of non-traditional things and break out of traditional thinking, I think, is more important.
Well, did you go to public schools in Boston proper?
We grew up in Lexington, which is, when I grew up, it was a sleepy little boonies town because it was too far, really, to be commutable.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's incredibly, like, it's a really, like, wealthy town now and very yuppified, and the downtown is very, like, commercialized. But that really wasn't true when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, like, now it's very commutable because what we consider a reasonable commute has expanded so much.
Mm.
So people will drive the 45 minutes to an hour to Boston from Lexington. But when I was a kid, that was, you know, it was so far out that it was cheap and professors could afford to live out there.
Okay.
So there's a lot of older professors.
Mm.
Young assistant professors, like, you know, could never live in Lexington now.
Okay.
Not like my parents did.
Yeah. Okay.
Like the Bay Area, probably, is the same thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. And you said that you were smart, but in a different way than your sister. In what ways were you smart?
I was maybe sort of less, I wasn't, like, she was really a math star, you know, but not so great at maybe other things. I shouldn't say that. She was very good at a lot of things, but really a math, I mean, she really stood out as math. Like, yeah. When you met her and you saw, like, how she lived, it was clear. You could have projected, I mean, her whole life would be math. It was absolutely obvious. And I think that wasn't really my story. It was more, I wasn't sure, like, what I was going to do, but I could do a lot of things pretty well, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I wasn't, like, one thing all the way, sort of.
Yeah.
Which I think actually is maybe better for me in this job, in the sense that I, you know, I probably have better sort of communication skills, you know, and with my students, that's maybe important.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was kind of a jock, you know, and that was the one thing my older sister really never was a jock, and I kind of distinguished myself as a jock.
Doing?
Soccer, and, you know, I went to Harvard actually to play soccer. I was kind of recruited onto the team, and, you know.
Yeah.
But it's not like I was a dumb jock. I was a pretty hardworking jock, but I wasn't, like, a genius. You know, I sort of had to work hard to do well.
Yeah.
My sister was just effortless, you know.
Right. Okay, so you did academically. How did you do in junior high and high school?
Yeah, I was fine. I did well.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was A's, you know. In my family, again, like, you just didn't show up with, like, a B, you know. That was just, your life was hell, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I did well in school mostly because I was terrified my parents would kick my butt, you know.
Yeah. Well, what would they do? What was the price?
You'd sit down every night with Dad, you know, and go through it and make sure that in the next test you got an A, you know.
Yeah.
Kind of, you know, it was like many evenings at the table after dinner doing math and physics and whatever you had to do better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
So you just, you know, you learned. You don't come home with a bad grade on a test to get in trouble. I mean, my parents were very intervened in our school a lot.
Okay.
Yeah. You know, like in our junior high, for example, my sister had a math teacher who was one of these old, like, assholes, you know, of the time that thought that girls do this, boys do that, right? And so she was so smart, you know, that she would go to these math classes, just kind of stare out the window because it was, like, gibberish to her what was going on in the classes. So the math teacher decided that she might have epilepsy. He called my parents and said, looks like she's having seizures because she's staring out the window. And really, she was bored off her butt, you know? I mean, she was smarter than her teacher, you know? And so, you know, my parents went in there and sort of taught him a lesson or two. And then my parents said to Andrea, you know, you should probably participate more in class because these teachers think that you have some disease or something. So she said, okay. So she would just, you know, and she, all the answers she just knew. You know, so the teacher would say, well, does anyone know? She, you know.
Yeah.
So then the teacher decided she was answering too many questions. So he called my parents and said, you know, she's acting too smart in class, and it's, she's not going to have that many friends if she acts this smart, you know. She's going to have a hard time making friends. So finally my dad went down there to the principal and got this guy fired.
Oh.
You know.
Yeah.
And after that, all the teachers were really afraid of my parents. Come down and kick up a stink, you know.
Yeah.
So I had, for example, I had a junior high school chemistry teacher who didn't apparently know that much chemistry, and I had a test, you know, I didn't do that well on it, and it turns out that a lot of the questions were wrong and that my answers were fine, but, you know, whatever. So my dad, you know, looked, he's like, oh my God, he marked you wrong for this, but that's correct, and he doesn't even know that, you know, and so on. Went down there and, you know, gave it to him, and I was so embarrassed, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, it was a pretty high standard household of academics.
Yeah.
So it was pretty tense, you know, growing up in that environment.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know.
Well,
again, they were, you know, you have to think of who my parents were. You know, they were a little older.
Mm-hmm.
When my mom had a hard time conceiving, so she didn't have us until she was in her late 30s. And,
okay.
You know, so she, my parents were both, like, pre the 60s social revolution. You know, they were very old world values, and, you know, they were very much had the values of their immigrant parents.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Did you speak Italian in the house?
No, not at all.
Your parents didn't?
He did with his family.
Okay, yeah.
But my mom didn't know any Italian, and she didn't like it when he would speak in a language that she didn't understand. And also, his family came from the Torino area, and they spoke a Piemontese dialect, which was different from the sort of conventional Italian.
Yeah.
So even Italians sometimes didn't understand my dad.
Yeah.
But he, you know, my dad could actually speak French, too, even though he never really learned it, just because the Piemontese had a lot of French influences from up near the border.
Yeah.
So no, you know, I just remember phrases that he would say to his mom and so on.
Yeah. Okay.
But, you know, I mean, yeah, it's too bad. Also, I think at that time, you know, in the 60s, it was sort of less cool to be speaking other languages. It was more of a nationalistic time.
Yeah. Okay. And how would you describe the quality of your education in the schools, junior high, high school?
I thought it was, in retrospect, I thought it was good. Mm-hmm. Although my mom had a lot of complaints about it, especially for my younger sister. I think, you know, my older sister and I were in these top classes. You know, they had levels back then. They probably still do. So you got placed either in the top or the middle or the bottom. And if you were in the top, I think it was great. You know, you were challenged and teachers treated you well and so on. But, you know, if you were in the bottom or the middle, I think, you know, you got the worst teachers. You know, the best teachers always got the best classes and so on. You know, so you get, you know, so my younger sister, who was never placed in these top classes, kind of got, a bad shake. You know, she really wasn't taught to read. In third grade, she really still wasn't reading. Mm-hmm. And whereas I, you know, we got taught to read pretty early. You know, before we went to school, we got taught to read kind of in preschool. And just didn't happen for my younger sister. So my mom has a lot of bitterness about the school system, mostly from my younger sister's experience. Mm-hmm. But I thought they did okay by me. Especially in music, you know, in high school, I spent more time doing music probably than anything else, and we had this great music program. You know, it was, we had the, I played in a jazz combo and all kinds of. I accompanied like three or four singing groups, and you know, I mean, and I don't think out in California, I don't see a lot of that. I don't think they have the money to do that out here. Yeah. But this is a wealthy town that I grew up in. You know. Yeah.
And what musical instrument did you play?
I play the keyboard, piano.
Yeah. Okay. And so when you had. You clearly got the cold shoulder when you broached the subject of becoming a musician. What else did you, when people would ask you what you wanted to be when you grew up, what would you say?
Back then?
Yeah.
I don't really remember. I might have said, oh, maybe I'll be a doctor. I like biology. Okay. I took biology in high school. It was a great class. I had a great teacher. And, you know, I might have said, I can imagine, I don't remember, but I can imagine myself saying biology or medicine or something like that.
Yeah. Okay.
It wasn't going to be math or physics. I didn't have the knack for it, and I couldn't compete with my older sister.
You know. Yeah, okay. And in the community you grew up in, you know, what did the other kids, what were they going to do? You know, the neighborhood kids that you hung out with, if you hung out.
It was
out.
Mixed.
Yeah.
A lot of kids from my high school went to college. Yeah. It was a pretty high frequency. You know, again, a lot of professors lived in Lexington.
Okay, so.
But some didn't. Yeah. It was mixed. There was a lot of. It's funny, because I have looked through my high school yearbook on occasion, you know, just nostalgia, you know, and there's a lot, I remember some of the kids, there was kind of groups of kids that were definitely college-bound and, you know, wanted to do well in school, and then there was groups of kids that weren't, you know, that were, you know, more kind of going to stick around town and maybe work in their dad's business or something after high school, you know.
Yeah.
There was a lot of family businesses around. There were a lot of Irish and Italian kids from big Irish and Italian families who had a lot of kids in them, and maybe they couldn't afford to go to fancy. You know, in the East Coast, it's different. You know, out here, you can go to a great school for cheap.
Mm-hmm.
In the East Coast, you really can't. You know, it costs a lot of money to go to a good school. And if you don't have the money, then you go to a state school, but the state schools are not that great out there like they are out here.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a lot of kids who, you know, thought they were going to put themselves through UMass or UNH mm-hmm. or UVermont or something like that. And, you know, those were universities where, you know, you didn't have to do that well to get in there and stuff. And, you know, so there were a lot of kids who would go to UMass and then drop out after a year or two, and they didn't have a big debt, so they really weren't that invested in it. But I do remember a lot of them going to college. I'd say over half of my high school went to college.
Mm-hmm.
And again, I was higher than the national percentage at that time. I don't know what it is now, but
yeah.
I certainly hung out with a very college-bound crowd.
Okay, yeah.
I mean, from my high school, for example, 11 kids in my class went to Harvard.
Wow.
We were kind of a local feeder public school.
Okay.
You know, we're probably one of the highest represented public schools at Harvard.
Yeah.
And then there's private schools that are heavily represented. Yeah. But, you know, and I remember a lot of kids from my class in high school going to, like, Tufts and Brandeis.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a lot of them stayed in Massachusetts, went to school.
Mm-hmm.
We were pretty parochial, and kids didn't really leave the East Coast that much. California, I didn't even know where California was. I had no idea. I'd never been anywhere. First plane ride I ever took was to visit Princeton to see if I want to go to college there.
Okay.
So I was like 18. It was the first time I'd ever been on an airplane. It's like a 45-minute flight, and I was like, oh my God, yeah. And because my sister had gone to Princeton, so naturally I would want to go to Princeton. And then I went to visit there, and I hated it. But and then that was the first flight. And then the second flight I ever took was when I visited grad schools.
Yeah.
And I flew out to California to visit Berkeley and Stanford.
Yeah.
And now when I fly all over the place, and there's like all these little kids on all these flights.
Right.
And was it always like that? I don't know. I mean, did little kids used to fly around? And
I don't know, because I didn't fly either till I was older. So, but yeah, a lot of people, a lot of my friends take their kids flying. It's nothing. Okay, and just to bring this up, you had mentioned it before, that what religious beliefs and practices did you participate in?
Well, my parents brought us to various Protestant churches. We're Protestant, I guess. But, you know, like, again, my dad was like, he would just go just to be with the family, but it's not like he was praying to God or anything. He didn't really believe in a higher power.
Yeah.
And so it was more of a social thing than a religious thing. But, you know, we went to, I can remember three different Protestant churches.
Yeah.
One actually was a Unitarian church.
Okay.
It was kind of a funky, hip sort of church, and that didn't last long. It wasn't, I don't think, quite traditional enough for my mom's taste. And then finally they settled on a Congregational Protestant church. Mm-hmm. So again, on the East Coast, there's all these little flavors of Protestant, and they're all different. And it's out here, I don't know that there's so much subtlety. But, and this church they settled on was one we could walk to. Mm-hmm. But what was great about that church was, and the reason I actually didn't mind going, was the organ. I mean, it had this spectacular organ with pipes up as far as you could see, with this enormous sound. And the guy who played the organ was a very well-known local musician who actually was kind of just his weekend gig. You know, he was a music teacher in one of the schools, local schools or something, and a composer, and conducted some orchestra or something. And he was phenomenal, you know, and he would just play these Bach and Mozart things, and he'd always be playing something as people were walking in. I'd get there early, you know, just to kind of hear this. Spectacular. And also the Congregational church, the sort of hallmark of that church is that the congregation participates, and mostly in the form of singing. So you'd have like a list of hymns you were going to sing during each, and there were like four or five of them. And every 5 minutes, the whole congregation would stand up and sing, and really sing, you know, with this huge organ just belting out, and it was just really fun, you know. And different, and we all stank. I mean, like, you know, none of us could really, it was a pretty big congregation of people, but just trying to sing, you know. And that was what was so great about it. It was a choir, and they were good, you know, and so I got to, as I got older, I became a teenager, I got the gig of leading the little junior choir, the little kids choir. So I would, you know, play and direct them, and then they'd go up there and perform every month or so. The junior choir would come up and sing for the congregation, and I would get to conduct them, so it was a big deal. Yeah. So that's what it was for me. It wasn't like a religious experience. It was more of a music experience.
Yeah.
But the funny thing is, out in California, it's a little different out here, and so when I first came out here, there was 1 year where my partner and I were like, oh, Christmas Eve service was kind of the biggest service of the year where I grew up, and you get to sing all the Christmas carol hymns, right? And so I said, oh, let's find a Christmas Eve service. I haven't been to church in years. I never went to church in college or anything like that. So let's find a church and go in Christmas Eve service so we can sing some of these, you know. Oh, yeah, great. So we found this church up the street. We were living in Noe Valley in San Francisco at the time. And so same time, it's a little church with this little piano, you know, it's kind of sorry little congregation. And then it's time to sing, and so a hymn starts, and I stand up, and I'm ready to sing, and everyone else is kind of sitting down. And I was like, oh, my God, you know. And then I sit back down again, all embarrassed, and then everyone starts singing in this tiny little voice, you know. And I was like, oh, no, you know, because I was ready to get up there and blah, you know. But it's just, I haven't found a church yet out here where people do that. Mm. Maybe I need a different religion out here or something.
Yeah.
So you must have grown up Catholic.
Yeah.
Right, is that right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Maybe there's some. Do people sing in a mass, Catholic mass?
Well, it's changed. When I was going to school, you know, when I was younger, it was, you know, post Vatican II, and you know, they brought in guitarists folk singers and all that other kind of stuff, and it's gone back to more traditional hymns that have been in the church for hundreds of years, so it just depends on what.
This Unitarian church was kind of hymns with a guitar kind of thing.
Yeah.
It was a little weird. You know, there was no Father, Son, and Holy Ghost or any of that stuff. It was just...
I think it depends on the church.
Yeah.
Well, what religious beliefs and practices have you carried on?
None, really.
None?
Yeah. To be honest, I never really had much. Yeah. Again, because my dad, you know, I mean, I looked at that and I was like, oh, I think Dad's probably right. Okay. Don't tell Mom, but I think Dad might be right, because, you know, shit happens, and how do you explain it? And, you know, I just, the logic of it was not there for me.
Yeah.
You know, I didn't have enough faith, I guess, to look past the logic problem.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I have no now religious affiliation. I haven't been to church again since that one midnight service in San Francisco where I didn't get to sing, you know. Oh, well.
Yeah. Well, and what about musical instruments? Do you still play the keyboard?
Yeah, I mean, recreationally, you know, nothing serious, but I have a piano at home that I tinker with, yeah.
Okay. Well, then, to move forward a little bit, you had mentioned that you were going to go to Harvard on a soccer scholarship.
It wasn't a scholarship, because technically Harvard doesn't do athletic scholarships.
Right. Yeah, okay, that's right.
But they sent a scout out to watch me play, and then I got in, and they, you know, sent, I was there to play, clearly.
Yeah.
But I didn't, actually.
Okay.
Because I figured out pretty quickly that, it's, you know, collegiate sports are pretty time-consuming. You have to travel a lot, and practices are every afternoon, and and all of a sudden you realize that there's no science majors on any of these teams because you can't handle it. You know, there's, you have labs in the afternoon. How are you supposed to do that? You know, so logistically it was impossible to major in science at Harvard and play one of these sports seriously. And so you have to make a decision.
Yeah.
And, you know, and well, again, like, I just, although my mother never told me that, you know, I just couldn't help but hear what would my parents think if I major in English just so I can play soccer, you know. when I don't really have a talent for English, and also, you know, it's not a viable profession, as my parents would have put it, you know. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, you know, so for a while, actually, after, you know, a few weeks into my freshman year, when things were sort of getting ready and I had the schedule, I was like, how am I going to do this, you know? And I was getting my schedule of courses together, and already I couldn't make half the practices just with my math and biology and everything I had to take. And I was like, what am I going to do? So I decided I couldn't play soccer, and coach was pissed, and so I decided, well, I have to do something, you know, because I couldn't imagine not being on some team, you know, so I actually went out for the crew team, because crew had their practices very early in the morning, so you could do an afternoon lab, right, so you'd get up at 4 in the morning, get down in the river, and row until 8, and then go to class, and this was unbelievably hectic, because, well, first of all, it's a grueling sport, and even though you have your afternoons free, you're so wasted by 8 in the morning that you can't really do anything the rest of the day. Do you ever row?
I was on a kind of recreational team.
So you know it's tough.
Very briefly.
Did you row in an 8?
Yeah.
That's what I rowed. And the other problem was that I didn't really have the body type to row. You need to be kind of tall and thin.
Petite.
And I had the kind of short, stocky soccer player's build, right? I didn't really have the right body. And so I weighed in as a heavyweight, but I was like a foot shorter than all the other heavyweights. And so the coach said to me, oh, yeah, she goes, if you lose 15 pounds, you could row as a lightweight. And I was like, how am I going to lose? I have to amputate a limb to lose 15 pounds. You know, I couldn't do it. I tried, you know, but your freshman year, there's kind of a force in the other direction, too. I could not lose 15 pounds my freshman year. So I had to row heavyweight, and I just stank. You know, I wasn't any good. And so I was kind of in the, you know, there were three boats, and I was in the third boat, you know. And so finally, you know what happened is I got mono. I got, because I was pulling all these all-nighters to get my work done and get to the boathouse by 4, you know, so on. I wasn't sleeping, and I got mono, and I was really sick, you know, so then I couldn't row, and then that was it. I decided I should just quit. So that was it. I never did a sport. And I chose biology as a major at that point, and I switched to chemistry later.
Okay. What other opportunities besides going to Harvard besides Princeton you looked at?
That was it.
Okay.
This is very parochial. Well, actually, I almost didn't look at Harvard because, again, my sister went to Princeton. Therefore, what other choice would there be for me but to go to Princeton? And I applied early admission to Princeton, got in, I was done. And then I went, said, you know, maybe I should go visit this place, you know, and my sister's there, I'll stay with her. So I went to visit, and it was awful. I thought it was that the students were snobs, and they were just preppy, and it was just, I felt really claustrophobic. It was this very suburban little golf course-y kind of, have you ever been there?
Mm-hmm.
It's Ivory Tower in the truest sense of the word, you know, and just the students I really couldn't stand, and even the ones I was visiting with on the same trip, they were all from private schools and had this attitude, and I said, oh my God, I don't think I could go here, you know. My sister loved it, but I just, you know, so kind of, the day of the deadline, I was like, oh my God, I've got to apply to some other place. What am I going to do? And so I applied to Harvard because it's there, you know. Mm-hmm. And I, thank God, got in there, you know. And I said, all right, God, I hope this is better. I went to visit Harvard and has totally, well, you know, Harvard Square, I'd kind of been in and out of a million times growing up. So I kind of already knew, you know, Harvard Square. And you know, Harvard it's definitely a kind of a snooty private school, but it's so diluted by the city that you don't have to necessarily notice that. You know, you're living in the city. So that was a much better fit for me. You know, I'm kind of more of a city person. And
yeah.
thank God, because I think I would have died if I had gone to Princeton. It would have killed me.
Okay. Let me flip the tape over.